Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. We volunteers at KABU are so thankful that the station is continuing to provide relevant information and wonderful music to help us maintain through this pandemic, and we're sure you share our feelings. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, KABU has had to cancel our spring pledge drive, but you can still help us out through these difficult times. Please consider becoming a member of KABU or renewing your membership if you are already a member by going to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right corner of the homepage. With the world's economy shut down as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, the air is cleaner in normally polluted cities around the world. Today we talk with Seattle atmospheric scientist Heather Price about the lessons we can glean from seeing air pollution and carbon emissions decrease as we all stay at home. What data does this give us about the causes of pollution and the best measures to reduce it once the economy restarts? Heather, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara.
I've seen you a few times testifying against the Tacoma LNG facility, and I'm just thinking about how we are taking a leap from all the issues and struggles that we have been dealing with for months and years into this pandemic. And I just wonder how that shift has affected the way that you're working and thinking.
Oh, boy. The changes with COVID, it feels like deja vu to me. The way that the public and our leaders are either listening to the experts in science and following the advice of experts in science related to COVID-19, is the parallels with the climate crisis are so clear to me. From when I first started hearing the inklings of COVID back in January and February, and now that we're on stay-at-home orders in our state. I'm in Seattle here in Washington, and I imagine you are too in Portland. So yeah, it feels like deja vu. And then also the justice and equity impacts of both of these, how people who are least able to deal with these impacts are the ones that are impacted most, right? We've got communities of color that are being impacted most by climate impacts and by COVID. Older folks, the parallels just continue in so many ways.
Well, one of the few bright sides of this pandemic is the bright skies that we're all experiencing. And my friends in Tacoma have been talking about how clean the air is even there, despite the port and everything that they're doing. And I've been looking at photographs from around the world, particularly ones that struck me were New York City and L.A., where the air is more sparkling and clear than I can imagine way before my lifetime started. So I wanted to talk in the beginning today about what we are learning from seeing clear skies as a result of the stay-at-home policy that we're all adhering to, or most of us are adhering to, except for Mike Pence.
In terms of the air pollution, I think what this really drives home for me, and this came up last week in an Earth Day forum with another atmospheric scientist at University of Washington, is the amount of time that these different pollutants persist in our air, right? So we've got these beautiful, clear skies. Even here in Seattle, I notice the difference in the air quality. I notice it in my son has asthma, and I even notice it for him in that he hasn't needed his inhaler, whereas usually at this time of year, the pollen really gets to him. And pollution is something that it's almost like it stacks. It's like filling a cup for people who have asthma and the things that exacerbate it. And so really what this shows is these air pollutants from burning gasoline, from burning coal and oil, the ones that really impact our health are very short-lived. The ones that are immediate impacts. Whereas the climate pollutants like carbon dioxide and methane, they're very long-lived, right? We're still putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We're still putting natural gas, fracked gas, methane into the atmosphere. But the short-lived ones, right, even just a month and boom, they're gone essentially from our atmosphere and we get these beautiful skies. But what a painful way to get this. This is not the way to solve air pollution issues. It's a hard way.
But what do you think are some of the lessons that we are learning right now by seeing the air cleared up? By the main thing that seems to be different is there's way fewer cars on the road.
I think the main lesson that I take from this is the benefit that we will see as we electrify transportation. Because right now, the air quality that we see is pretty close to what we would see if buses were electrified, our cars were electrified, right? If we went to electricity, battery-based transportation rather than fossil fuel-based transportation, we would see these reductions in air quality.
However, this isn't making that much difference as far as carbon pollution goes, is it?
No, this is not making much difference in terms of carbon pollution, right? People still are, if you have gas going to your home, you're still heating your home, you're still cooking if you have a gas stove. There's still ships with bunker fuel going back and forth, or LNG going back and forth across the Pacific. There's still airplanes. I think the number I saw is there's still about, 60% of the flights are still going on. So the carbon, sure, we've reduced the amount of carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere, but carbon persists for centuries. So you could think of it, and Catherine Hayhoe, who is a great communicator of science, she's at Texas Tech, she put it in terms of bricks, right? We've been putting bricks onto this pile, which is our atmosphere. You can think of a brick as a carbon dioxide brick of carbon dioxide, but we're putting it into the atmosphere. And this year, maybe our brick is 25% smaller, but we're still putting that brick onto the pile. We're still increasing the pile. And the only solution, and really it's not even a solution, the only action that is really going to address the climate crisis is to stop putting bricks on the pile. And that means zero. That means no burning of coal, oil, and gas, net zero. And we have the time of a mortgage, a home mortgage to do this in. We have 30 years to get to zero. And that means electrifying everything. I think that some of the big lessons here are the fact that our transportation is responsible for so much of our air pollution, and that really is low-hanging fruit when it comes to addressing the climate crisis, that if we move our buses, our cars, our transportation over to electric, that will have a big impact on human health, not just on climate, but also on human health. Transportation is 29% of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. So by reducing our amount of pollution coming from cars, if we move it to electricity, we're also addressing that 29% of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. It's a big piece of the puzzle.
I've been involved in some discussions about Michael Moore's new movie, where he's basically trashing the mainstream environmental movement because he's saying that renewable and sustainable doesn't mean anything, and that moving to electric vehicles is not going to solve the climate crisis. But 29%, it might not solve it all, but it seems like 29% is a pretty big chunk of our carbon emissions.
Yeah, more than a quarter. It's pretty big. And electricity, these are the numbers from 2017 that I'm quoting, right? Transportation's 29%, electricity is around 28%, and that the greenhouse gas emissions from electricity are going down because of the growth in wind and solar. And I think that's one of the things that Michael Moore was missing in his movie, right? The movie was made using data, some data that's more than 10 years old. And we've seen reductions in the cost of solar, right? It's cut in half just within the past decade. So I think he's already a little bit outdated. Texas now gets more of its electricity from wind than it does from coal. And Texas is known for its use of coal and oil and gas. And even there, they're seeing this transition over. So I'm a little suspect of where Michael Moore is getting his data.
So maybe the same place that Puget Sound Energy's environmental impact statement was getting their climate data from like 2007, something like that.
Possibly, yeah. If the science is moving forward, and we need to really be looking at the latest science. Just like with COVID-19, we can't look at the science from December. We need to look at the science from April of 2020, not December of 2019. Science changes, the scientists and the experts' views change as the science changes. And even for me, being an atmospheric chemist, my views on methane have changed drastically from when I was a postdoc working with methane data sets in my global chemical transport model to now being informed by new data that comes out from colleagues like Robert Howarth at Cornell. We now know natural gas is not a bridge fuel that I once thought it was.
Well, let's talk a bit about methane for a second. It's a little bit maybe off subject to COVID-19, but I think it's a really important thing to look at what has changed about our views and our understanding about methane as a greenhouse gas and what is not being said by those, particularly the natural gas industry, that's still really trying to promote gas as not just a bridge fuel, but I think actually for the fuel of the future.
When I started grad school back in, 1998, somewhere around there, and then my postdoc in the early 2000s, I was working with methane data sets. I'm an atmospheric chemist, and everything that we understood was that methane, when you burn it, it is more efficient. You get more energy out of it per carbon, right? Per carbon dioxide that goes into the air. So when you burn it, it is much more efficient. The problem is it's a gas. And when you have, there's natural gas, which is a gas. You've got coal, which is a solid. And then you've got oil, gasoline or diesel, which is a liquid. Coal is not a greenhouse gas. You have to burn it to turn it into a greenhouse gas. It's a solid, right? It's not a gas. I teach this to my general chemistry students too. You know, we learn about solid, liquids, and gases. Oil and diesel and these other fossil fuels, they're liquids. They're not greenhouse gases either. You have to burn them in order for them to turn into greenhouse gases, whereas methane, fracked natural gas, it already is a greenhouse gas. So all it needs to do is leak. And any small child can tell you if you've got a gas, right? They've got their helium balloons and their balloon shrinks because that gas can leak even just through the pores in a balloon. So of course, natural gas is going to leak. The issue is how much does it leak? And we haven't known that. When I was in grad school and in my postdoc, we did not know how much it leaks. And now we have a much better handle on the leak rate, thanks to the work of Dr. Howarth and other researchers around the world, and also using isotopic fractionation. There's a signature for methane that comes from fossil fuels compared to methane that's biogenic coming from cows or marshlands or wetlands. And so the signature of fossil fuel methane is much better understood. And we're finding that the leak rate is high enough that it is likely that fracked natural gas is as bad or worse than coal because it leaks, right? And if it leaks, you're not burning it. You're not getting the energy out of it. And when it leaks, that methane molecule is 86 times more potent than carbon dioxide, right? A carbon dioxide gets a global warming potential of 1, whereas a methane molecule for about the first 10 years gets a global warming potential of 86.
I mean, one of the, I think, justifications for methane use is that it disappears sooner in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide does. But how much of an impact does that actually have?
So the methane molecule has that, you brought up the lifetime in the atmosphere, right? So methane, if I put 100 molecules of methane into the air, after about 10 years, half of them are going to turn into carbon dioxide, which then persists for centuries, right? Carbon dioxide lasts for a really long time in our systems, in our ocean, water, and air. Methane, half of it's gone in 10 years. I gave the number of 86 times stronger. So methane is 86 times stronger as a greenhouse gas or more potent as a greenhouse gas over a 20-year period.
But if I shorten that down to a year or two, or within 10 years, it's actually more like 100 times stronger, more potent than carbon dioxide. So methane, it packs a punch as a greenhouse gas. And it'll be interesting to see, right? We don't run our cars on natural gas. So we don't expect as much of a reduction of natural gas use during this COVID time compared to gasoline and oil, which is why we're seeing such an impact and improvement in air quality right now.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Seattle atmospheric chemist Heather Price about the lessons we can glean from seeing air pollution and carbon emissions decrease as we all stay home. So let's go back to what we have more control of right now and why it's so important, actually, to see a reduction in air pollution in all these communities that have been really struck hard by the COVID virus.
So these reductions in air pollution, I don't know how helpful that is for current patients of COVID. I mean, of course, the worse that air pollution is, the more it's going to impact your health, particularly particulate pollution called PM 2.5 micron, really small particles that can get deep into the alveoli of the lungs. The real issue around air pollution and COVID that I've been reading are things like a study that came out of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And this study shows that if for people who live in historically air polluted regions with PM 2.5 particulate pollution, that folks have a higher incidence of death associated with COVID-19. For example, if a person lives for decades in a country that has high levels of those fine particulate pollutions, those folks are 15% more likely to die from COVID-19 than someone who lives in a region that has very low levels of particulate pollution. So it's the cumulative impact of air quality over the years that really is impacting folks with COVID compared to, right, everyone is benefiting from the cleaner air quality today, including COVID patients.
Well, there seem to be two parts to that issue. And the first was a study that started coming out, I think in March, late March, but was first described actually on my show by Deborah Davis back on March 30th about how there was this correlation between highly polluted areas and the worst COVID cases. And in fact, I guess Wuhan, China is one of the most polluted parts of China. And this, as we learn more and more, these really intense industrial facilities there. So I wonder about looking at that and what more we're learning about is COVID, was it actually exacerbated, and were people more inclined to be infected by it because of all the air pollution in these particular regions?
Yes, I think that study out of Harvard is that's what they're comparing, is they're looking at these polluted regions and what are the death rates, and then, you know, they have to take into account age, gender, all of these other, they're trying to take into account all of those so that they can really isolate this population lived with pollution and this population didn't. And then here are the differences in morbidity and mortality. And they're seeing that if you've lived in a place like Wuhan or Beijing or Los Angeles, your chances of dying from COVID are going to be 15% higher than someone who, say, grew up in a clean air environment.
Did you see anything, or do you know of any correlations that are made between the propensity to even be infected by the disease living in a high pollution area?
I haven't seen anything on the propensity for people to contract the disease based on air pollution, though.
So the other thing that's been really interesting that's just starting to come out is discussions about whether the COVID virus can attach itself to air pollution particles. And I was wondering what you know about that.
That's very interesting to think about different viruses attaching themselves to air pollution and then being transported. We know that aerosols, my research during my PhD, I looked at the long-range transport of pollution coming across the Pacific. And we measured pollution. We had a study where we had collaborators in Asia that were measuring pollution. And then we were able to measure that same kind of plume as it came across the Pacific 5 to 7 days later. And we could see it. It was thick enough that, you know, those dust storms and that air pollution, you could see it with the naked eye as it came across the Pacific. And so we know that these particles can come across. The question is, can the virus particle survive on those? So that when they come across, right, or even within a room, right, if you have particulate pollution that is created in a home or from a car and it picks up a piece of that virus, can it sustain, can it survive on those particles? And it seems like it's much more likely that the aerosol particles that our body creates when we talk, when we cough, those are the ones that epidemiologists and our doctors are more concerned about than the air pollution. Because think about it, you've got the air pollution particle, somehow it needs to meet the aerosol that's come out of your mouth, right, in order for them to then move on and infect someone. And so there's lots of science questions in there.
Well, I'm thinking about some of the conspiracy theories that are coming out of the Trump administration about these this laboratory in Wuhan that was manufacturing the COVID-19 genetically engineered virus and all these other ones. And I was just thinking how people could kind of go to town with the thought that COVID-19 came to from China to the United States on pollution particles. As we know, for instance, here in Portland, we could see all the pollution in the Columbia River Gorge that comes from China, besides the stuff that we make here. So I just wonder how we counteract this kind of hysteria and conspiracy theories that really obscure what we really need to be dealing with right now.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, the things that I just brought up, I would hope somebody would not pick those up thinking that that is a viable way for a virus to spread, is for it to come across on a pollution particle from Asia. That's, I think, highly, highly unlikely that, you know, we already know that the virus does not survive very long, outside, right? Even on a piece of cardboard or something, it doesn't survive very long. So the likelihood of it surviving on a piece of soot as that came from a coal plant or from the tailpipe of a car seems highly unlikely. It's much, much more likely to get it from aerosols, from people coughing, right? Especially if a person is not wearing a mask, right? If you're wearing a mask and you cough, that collects those aerosols, you know, a good percentage of them within the mask. And so I think if people are looking for ways to protect themselves, it's through wearing masks from each other, right? So you don't, so much of what's going on, we don't even know who's symptomatic and who's asymptomatic, right? Or who among the asymptomatic are shedding the virus.
Well, I saw another interesting study that they're doing where they're sort of coming to an understanding that the amount of aerosol that is actually has the potential to infect other people, it's more concentrated in closed areas, which sort of reaffirms my practice, which is that I generally don't wear a mask when I'm going out walking and when I'm going into parks, which are still open in Portland. And I just try to stay away from people's mouths and I keep 6 feet away from everybody. And hopefully everybody will also respect that. But that being in closed areas is much more of a concern. And one of the interesting parts of the study is I saw that one of the most contaminated places were the rooms where medical workers change their protective garments and equipment, and that the rooms are so full of the COVID virus just floating around in the aerosol particles that, in fact, they're infecting their protective gear. I was wondering if you've been hearing anything about that.
I did. I remember reading an article about that just yesterday about the workers where they were shedding their clothes after being on a shift, that they were seeing higher levels of viral pieces, not necessarily the full virus, but pieces of it in the air. And it's not too surprising. When I was in grad school, I worked with measuring outside air. And so I had these samples, and I had to be really careful not to open my my samples or to get indoor air, because indoor air has so many more particulates in it, these fine particulates compared to outdoor air. And so I'm not surprised to find that, yeah, in stagnant indoor air, there's going to be a lot higher incidence of COVID compared to in a well-ventilated room or outdoors. And like you, I also, when I go into stores to do my shopping, I wear a mask. But when I go out for a walk with my family or to walk my dog, I have not been wearing a mask. And I ran into one of my neighbors on a walk. We stayed like 10 feet away from each other. But she's a doctor, and she tests COVID patients, and she wasn't wearing a mask either.
So that's reassuring.
That made me think, okay, if you're not wearing a mask and you're actually out there testing patients for COVID, then I think it's probably okay for us to, if we're not in a crowded space. Now, if I was out on the Burt Gilman or at a park where there's a lot of people, I probably would want to wear a mask and would want others to wear a mask. But where I go walking, it's usually just me and my dog or me and my family. And it's interesting. People are crossing streets to avoid each other, and people really are paying attention to that 6-foot distance. And in fact, I see people crossing the street. So they're really keeping track of that. So I do feel okay with that. But as more and more people are out there, I would don a mask even outdoors, depending on the number of people.
Actually, my wife and I, when we go out walking, it used to be we're the ones who were always walking into the street. And now we're kind of waiting to see, how soon the people who are approaching us are going to do it. And more, actually, fewer and fewer times now, we're the ones who have to walk into the street. So we appreciate that people are really taking that seriously. But there's still, it's really disconcerting for me that there still are a number of people, and most of them are probably under 30, who don't seem to get it, and particularly the people who bike or skateboard or run right past us and other people who are out walking. I'm wondering if you're seeing that in Seattle as well.
Yes. So early on, we live near a trail called the Burt Gilman Trail, and my family and I, we like to go for bike rides on the weekends, and usually we do that on the Burt Gilman. And so one of the weekends in March, we went down to the Burt Gilman and we were going to ride on it. And I looked at all the people on the Burt Gilman, and no one was wearing a mask at that time. And we just kind of looked and said, well, I think we'll just go on the roads. if you're on a small trail that's only about 10 feet wide, it's hard to get 6 feet from people. And especially if you're going in the same direction as someone, right? If somebody's huffing and puffing, and then you're running through their huffing and puffing, right? Those aerosols can survive that short a distance, that's for sure. So I would not feel safe out on a trail like that without wearing a mask, for sure.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Seattle atmospheric chemist Heather Price about the lessons we can glean from seeing air pollution and carbon emissions decrease as we all stay home. Though right now we're kind of speculating as both neither one of us epidemiologists about why we should be wearing masks. I think that's kind of, it's interesting conversation to get in with everybody. I mean, today I went down to this wetland that's near my house, and I haven't been down there in a month because the trails are narrow, and there's these boardwalks, and I had too many runners just like running right past me. So we stopped going there, and I was realizing I'm missing the baby ducks. Actually, it turned out they haven't hatched yet. In fact, there were very few ducks down there today, but I went down. Fortunately, there was hardly anybody there, but I had my mask in my pocket, and I feel like I've really changed my behavior in the last month, because I was one of the holdouts not to wear masks until I started wearing masks about 3 weeks ago. And for one thing, I felt like I needed to believe it was really going to make a difference, and that's a very confusing thing, and I think people don't understand that the reason you're wearing the mask is not to protect yourself, but to protect other people. And I've had some very outraged mask wearers before I started wearing a mask a lot, getting mad at me for not wearing a mask as they were standing 2 feet away from me. And I was asking them to socially distance themselves. So I'm kind of curious about, you know, thoughts about how we can sort of help people understand what the mask is for.
Oh, the whole education piece is so key with anything related to science. And yeah, I'm not an epidemiologist. I am not a doctor, so I'm not an expert at this at all. So I would encourage anyone listening, go to the CDC website, go to your public health website, and listen to what the experts say. If the experts start telling us, hey, wear masks outside, then we should wear masks outside. Right now, they're kind of leaving it up to us for our outdoor mask wearing to make that decision for ourselves. And yeah, the question of how do we educate the public? And I think it's really about pointing them to the experts, pointing them to the trusted experts out there. And in this case, that's the epidemiologists, it's our virologists, it's our doctors. And you and I, we can speculate all we want, but we're not the experts.
It's a good thing that Anthony Fauci has very high popularity ratings in this country, because I do feel like he's somebody that I listen to and pretty much trust what he's saying. I wonder, are there other people that you think are out there that have that same kind of ability to communicate and connect with people?
Regarding COVID or regarding climate?
Well, we'll get to climate in a moment. In a way, it's similar. Actually, let's kind of do that, both in terms of climate and COVID, because in a way, a lot of people are seeing these two issues as kind of getting intertwined with each other.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of COVID, I feel very fortunate to live in Washington State, where we have this biotech hub with the University of Washington, the virology lab. And so I know for myself, early on, I started following on Twitter the University of Washington Virology Lab, the King County Health Department, and some of their scientists and researchers. And so I think for folks, not necessarily individual people, but just our public health, and to go to those experts.
Do you think the same thing is true for climate change? I mean, I think there's actually less skepticism about the crisis of climate change now than there was a few years ago, though it seemed like Donald Trump has not helped to increase a concern about it. But I wonder the same thing about how do we help people to understand who they should listen to and what they need to hear.
For climate change, I think the challenge there is that it has been polarized and politicized. In the 20 years that I've been a climate scientist, at first when I would go to... when I would travel and I would talk to people internationally, nowhere in the world except in the United States was there questions of, is climate change real? And it's not a matter of, is climate change real? Is fossil-fueled climate change real? That's really the question. And then there's this framing that is, I think, been very damaging to our need for climate action in the United States. It's the obfuscation of the science by the fossil fuel industry and the people who, their lobbyists, the folks that support them and profit from them. It's very, very much profit driven. So the maligning of the scientists, the obfuscation of the science, and also maligning of activism and the actions that are needed. I mean, I think that even folks that are, the latest ones that I've been seeing have to do with renewables. People saying, oh, well, you know, you can't drive an electric car because it's going to be worse than a gas car because of the battery. And that is an old myth, right? Today, an electric car reaches parity in terms of its carbon emissions within about 6 months compared to a gasoline car. And then after that, it's a net negative compared to the gasoline car. As the gasoline car, for every mile driven, it's pumping carbon into the atmosphere, whereas the electric car, especially if that electric car is running off of solar panels on someone's roof or off of wind and solar, community wind and solar, there is no carbon emission for the use of that car, for the driving of that bus or that car or whatever it is, the transportation that's being run.
I'm having this thought. I'm remembering at both of the hearings that I saw you and recorded you testifying around Tacoma LNG, and the proponents of Tacoma LNG, most of them hired by Puget Sound Energy, who's sponsoring that project, would talk about how the opponents are not listening to the science. And since the environmental impact statement didn't agree with their views, then they were just dismissing the science in that report. And then I remember you and a number of other people getting up, particularly you getting up and saying, my name is Heather Price, and I'm an atmospheric scientist. And it just kind of hit like, yeah, they don't have anybody from the other side who's a scientist who's testifying. So what role do you see yourself playing in terms of dealing with that obfuscation that has been so huge on the part of the fossil fuel industry?
They're getting more subtle with it. They, meaning the fossil fuel industry, they're still out there obfuscating. The latest obfuscation that I saw was last year, Puget Sound Energy put out what is called a op-ed. If anyone has heard of that. So there's op-eds, which are, opinion editorials that people write for newspapers. But it is a common practice for companies to put out op-eds. So it's an opinion kind of advertisement. And Puget Sound Energy put one out in the Seattle Times last year where they were talking about how people could reduce their carbon footprint, right? And the things that they suggested in there were things like change your shower head, insulate your home, buy offsets when you travel. Nowhere in there was actually replacing your heat, your stove with an induction stove, replacing your heat with a heat pump that would be electric, right? Everything in there protected their use and continued sale of natural gas.
Well, I understand. I read an article where it seems like the natural gas industry sees the whole movement towards electrification as an existential crisis for them, which is kind of interesting because we're talking about the existential crisis of climate change, and they see the whole climate change movement as an existential crisis for the fracked gas industry.
Yes, and it should be. The fracked gas industry needs to go out of business, essentially. Like I said at the beginning, we have until 2050 to go to net zero. That means zero burning or zero amount of fossil fuel derived carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere from the burning of coal, oil, or natural gas. That means that those companies, that they're not sustainable. And yes, it is an existential crisis for them because they're going to have stranded assets.
Well, I'm wondering if you're concerned about how the struggle, like you've been really involved in trying to stop Tacoma LNG and probably a number of other issues like that in the Puget Sound area. And now everybody is staying at home and it's very hard to, there's no hearings. All the hearings that there are Zoom meetings, I'm assuming, and people can't gather in the street and have rallies. But what is going on while the rest of us are at home? What's going on with the fossil fuel industry, particularly in your region?
That is a good question. What is going on with the fossil fuel industry in my region and around the world? I think they're still marching on. What I've heard lately is that the fossil fuel industry is going to get a bailout with COVID-19. Right? People are not using oil. They're not driving as much. They're not flying as much. And so that has had a pretty disastrous impact on the oil industry. The fracked gas industry was already in decline as more and more cities and states move away from gas hookups, right? You look at Menlo Park, Berkeley, even our neighbors to the north, Vancouver, BC, and all of these cities are moving away from natural gas hookups, right? Fracked gas hookups in buildings and homes. Even here in Seattle, the city is not going to allow the hookup of gas in new buildings, new city buildings. And so those industries, they have a lot of assets, right? They have a lot of gas in their pipelines, and that they're actively fracking, that even according to the science cannot get burned, right? If we want to stop, if we want to listen to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the scientists there and stop at 1.5 degrees of warming, which we're at 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming today, if we want to stop at 1.5, which is what scientists say is kind of an upper limit, it's going to be pretty bad there, pretty disastrous even at 1.5, then we have to leave half of the fossil fuel reserves in the ground. And these are the ones that we already know about, not even the ones that they're still out there actively fracking and searching for and looking for. These are just the ones on the books to stop at 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Seattle atmospheric chemist Heather Price about the lessons we can glean from seeing air pollution and carbon emissions decrease as we all stay at home, and also some of our concerns about the fossil fuel industry just marching on while the rest of us are quarantined. Another concern that a lot of people are raising is that from the Trump administration, there's all these marching orders to do away with regulations or to suspend regulations for now. And how do you see that playing out?
Yes, I'm seeing the EPA and under the Trump administration suspending a number of air pollution, water pollution, you know, just pollution rules in favor of industry. And yeah, that's not helping. Right now we have good air quality because people are not driving and flying. But what happens when we go back after we get a handle on COVID? Because that's coming, right? This is not going to last for, you know, we're going to, I hope, get to the end of COVID. We'll get hopefully a vaccine. Hopefully we'll have immunity to this, unlike climate. So these air pollution rules, right? Once the economy starts getting going again, this is going to exacerbate the pollution that we already were dealing with.
I've actually been having a funny reaction in the last couple of days where I'm finding myself kind of getting used to this way of living. And there's a lot of it that is very stressful. And I really worry about all the small businesses I care about and the ones that I don't even know about that are going to possibly go under. And of course, all the death that's resulting. But there's something about the way that we are slowing down right now. And I just wonder how we can, because I'm really concerned about opening up too soon. I'm thinking about what are the lessons we really need to learn before we open up?
Wow. So what are the lessons that we really need to learn before we open up? To listen to the experts, I would say, right? To not even open up until we... until the experts tell us that it's okay to. And I think that they have a list of certain things that we need to see done related to testing, related to tracing, things like that, before we can open up safely to protect human lives.
Well, I'm thinking too about the mayor of Paris, who wants to, as they open up, keep cars out of Paris as much as they're being kept out right now. And I'm just thinking that while we're still locked down, so to speak, if there's a way to visualize what our communities could be like in a post-COVID-19 world that would have reaped some of the benefits that we have right now by not having all this pollution that we just have become accustomed to over the last 100 years or so.
Yeah, it's encouraging to see so many cities embracing walking, biking, giving people mobility on the streets, closing down roads. I know here in Seattle, there's a number of roads that have been shut to traffic so that people can walk and bike, because with the stay-at-home order, you know, people still need to exercise. And so hopefully this will create a culture shift. You said you're getting used to a lot of these changes, and I think that other people will too. People will get used to having certain roads closed on the weekends where they can go and bike on them or walk on them, and there won't be traffic. You won't have the pollution on those roads, and hopefully that will seep its way into our daily culture post-COVID.
I just wonder if there's a way that we can go back to being in business and still maintain some of the sort of the quietness, the lack of cars, the lack of noise, the lack of pollution. Because some of the things that concern me about getting back to business is that we're going to lose some of this connectedness to quietness and to cleanliness and to the things that have been really good about the reality we've been living in. And I wonder how we can bring that forward into the post-COVID-19 world.
How can we bring forward some of this quiet, some of this connectedness? I think part of that is to be just cognizant that it's there, right? If we voice that, hey, you know, we're connecting more with our neighbors, we're enjoying the quiet, we're enjoying the air quality, I think people, when we start to open up again, are going to want to continue those things. I would hope, right? And I think the more that we talk about that, I think the more likely it is that those things will come to fruition, that people will shut down parts of cities for walking, that people will push for the electrification of the auto industry, right? If you look at Norway, in 2025, by 2025, you're not going to be able to buy a gasoline car in some cities in Norway. They won't be sold, only electric. And already something like 60% of the cars sold in Norway in 2019 were electric. So this is coming, and the air quality, it's also quieter, right? As we move toward electrification of our transport, even our buses, right? Right now our buses are diesel. And as we move to electric buses, that's not going to have that billowing black smoke that exacerbates asthma and heart disease. And the United States, we have a lot of room to grow that. China has nearly 500,000 electric buses on the road. Almost half of their buses, their public buses, are electric. Compared to the United States, we've got less than 10,000. We have far fewer. Even per capita, we've got far fewer electric public transport than even China. So I think that can be a place where people can push for the changes that they want to try to keep some of these things that we've gotten used to.
Well, in the beginning of this interview, you talked about the connections or the similarity in the way that our administration has dealt with the COVID-19 pandemic and with climate change. And I want to go back to that and talk about maybe how what we're going through right now with COVID-19 is maybe a precursor of what we need to be facing with climate change, which is going to be a lot more extreme than what we're experiencing right now.
Right now with COVID-19, this is a really terrible time for everyone in the world. Especially for folks that are impacted more by this, right? We're all in this together, but we're not equally impacted by it. And that's the same with climate, right? Those who are least responsible for fossil-fueled climate change are the ones who are most impacted by it. And so those parallels between COVID and climate in that way.
We've been struggling ever since Trump became president with a huge amount of climate denial and a lot of just refusing to take it seriously and stripping away all the regulations that were instituted during Obama's administration. So I wonder, how do we look at how would you compare, I guess, Trump's response to COVID-19 with his response to climate change, and how can that be confronted?
It really goes back to listening to experts. And as far as I've seen from the Trump administration, they've very rarely heeded the warnings of experts. If they had, they would not have shut down the pandemic response teams in 2018. We would have had those. We would have had a pandemic response team in China that probably could have, helped mitigate the spread. But we don't know that, right? That got shut down. And climate denial is very similar, right? It's a matter of listening to the experts, and that has not been done at the federal level. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. They've done everything that they can to basically continue the work of the fossil fuel industry in obfuscating the science, in maligning the scientists and the educators and the folks who are trying to educate people as to the impacts of fossil fueled climate change. And they've done a beautiful job of making it political, so that it is very much an ideological position. The best way to know if someone, quote unquote, believes in climate change is to ask them whether they are conservative or progressive. And folks, the more conservative a person is, the more likely they are to deny the science and the reality of climate change. Another thing that I think obfuscates the science and has been perpetuated actually in the media is this idea that people either believe in climate change or they don't believe in climate change. And it is a pet peeve of mine and of my colleagues in science to ever say whether you believe or don't believe in something that is science-based. And people in the media do this all the time. They say, how do you deal with people who don't believe in climate change? And I say, I don't believe in climate change either. I understand fossil fuel climate change. I understand the science, but I don't believe in it. I believe in my religion, right? That's something to believe in. But science is not something to be believed or not believed. It's based on evidence and testing. And if the evidence and the science and the testing changes, so will my view of whatever that topic is, whether that topic is COVID-19 or climate or gravity, right? You never ask somebody, do you believe in gravity? It's, do you understand it?
Well, what's your hope in the next few weeks? How do you see yourself, I guess, taking the best advantage of this period and as we prepare to re-enter the world as we knew it at some point in the undetermined future?
What is my hope for the next few weeks? My hope is that it will only be the next few weeks, but my hope is that people find a way to support each other. There are so many people out there that are hurting, hurting emotionally, hurting economically, hurting physically from the illness itself, from COVID-19. And I guess my hope over the next few weeks, regardless of how we come out of this or how we, if we have to continue with these stay-at-home orders, is just that we're kind and supportive of each other. That's my hope in the root of it all. And that goes for climate as well, that I hope people are able to just be kind, talk about it, listen to the experts.
Well, Heather, it's really great to talk to you. So thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Barbara.
Today, we've been talking with Seattle atmospheric chemist Heather Price, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. Because the COVID-19 pandemic has forced us to cancel our spring pledge drive, which would be going on right now, we are asking you, our listeners, to help us if you can by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. We understand that these times are hard for all of us and that many of you are in no position to give away any money, but if you can, we really appreciate it. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we talk with Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist at the GEOS Institute in Ashland, Oregon, about links between the COVID-19 pandemic and our mistreatment of the planet. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by the Incredible String Band. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.
My blood and the blood kiss me.